Thank you very much. So as was said, I'm a postdoc at Penn State right now. So I do a lot of work on sort of phenomenological studies of ultra-energy cosmic ray sources and their multi-messenger connections. But I'm also working on a couple of neutrino experiments, including the Skarion radio array and the Radio Neutrino Observatory in Greenland. So I'm happy to talk about any of those if anyone's interested. But today I'm going to be telling you about some new ways that I think we can probe the source evolution of ultra-energy cosmic ray sources. Okay, so let's just start with some background on cosmic rays. So cosmic rays are nuclei that are arriving at Earth. And the cosmic rays that I'm interested in are at ultra-high energies, meaning that they have energies above 1 eV, which is 10 to the 18 electron volts. And despite the fact that we've known about these particles since the 1960s, we still don't really know much about their origins. And there's a few reasons for this slow progress. One is that the flux is extremely low. So at the highest energies, it's less than one cosmic ray per kilometer squared per century. So right away, you have a statistics problem. But you know, if you detected one of these particles, maybe you could just look where it's coming from and understand what its sources are. But of course, it's not so easy because cosmic rays are charged. And so they'll have significant deflections in the galactic magnetic field so that they actually don't point back to their sources at all. Even this wouldn't be a problem. If you have a good model of the galactic magnetic field, there's some really nice models out on the market, like the one depicted in this cartoon. And you could just go ahead and backtrack through the galactic magnetic field to see where this particle really came from. But even that's not possible because we actually don't know what exactly the composition of cosmic rays are at these energies. And that's primarily due to uncertainties in particle physics at these energy scales, right? So we're a few orders of magnitude above the center of mass energy of even the LHC. So that makes this very challenging, but we can adopt models of what hadronic interactions might be like at these energies. And from that, we've learned qualitatively that the composition's actually getting heavier at the highest energies. So it's not just protons. It seems like there's heavier nuclei like silicon and iron in the spectrum. One other thing that we've learned in recent years is that cosmic rays at these energies are primarily or exclusively of extragalactic origin. And the best evidence for this is the dipole that's been measured in their arrival directions by the Pierre Auger Observatory. And this dipole is about 120 degrees from the galactic center. So that's our best evidence they're actually extragalactic in origin. So in light of what we know, in spite of all these challenges, you know, we're still trying to hunt down what the actual sources of these particles are and trying to understand how they managed to be accelerated to such high energies. Now, that hasn't stopped people.
So is that dipole corrected for this deflection you mentioned from our galactic magnetic field?
No, this is what's actually observed at Earth. So I'll touch a bit on that later. But yeah, that's a very good point. Yeah.
But then how then does this tell you that it's extragalactic? I mean, you couldn't have, you know, the local magnetic field deflecting things to make this dipole?
Yeah, so it turns out if you do the simulation, so you would expect that if there are cosmic ray sources in the galaxy, that they're primarily in the plane and at the core of the galaxy. And so if you assume that cosmic rays come from there and you, again, try to backpropagate or forward propagate them to Earth through these galactic magnetic fields, you actually end up somewhere over here. So, yeah. Okay, so like I was saying, people haven't been hindered by this. They've come up with lots of ideas of where these particles might be accelerated. And just to name a few candidate sources, people think about environments like active galactic nuclei, starburst galaxies, and tidal disruption events. Now, I just want to talk a little bit about how we actually detect these particles. And there are two main ways that these particles are detected. So the slightly more direct way that we're able to detect them is through the observation of extensive air showers that they initiate when they arrive at Earth. And the less direct way that we can try to learn about cosmic rays is through observation of the neutral secondaries that they produce. So let me go ahead and start with these extensive air showers. So the two leading ultra-energy cosmic ray observatories today are the Telescope Array in the United States and the Pierre Auger Observatory that's depicted on the right here in Argentina. And both of these arrays have to be enormous to overcome that very low flux that I mentioned earlier. So the Pierre Auger Observatory is about 3,000 square kilometers. For me, coming from the US, I usually like to think that's about the size of Rhode Island. Okay, so it's an enormous array. And both of these detectors employ a so-called hybrid detection method, which is to say that they're actually two separate detectors that are working in tandem. So the first of these is the surface detector array, which is depicted by all these black points in this map here. And each of those black points is a water Cherenkov tank. And then overlooking the ground array are fluorescence telescopes that are depicted by these blue lines here, and you can see them in the photograph. And these actually overlook the ground array to try to observe the air showers as they develop. So what the fluorescence telescopes can actually do is the following. So when a cosmic ray enters the Earth's atmosphere to initiate one of these air showers, and as the air shower develops, more and more particles will be produced and will travel along in the shower until eventually energy losses start to dominate over particle production, and then the number of particles in the shower will decrease. And so that's depicted in this cartoon here by the cyan line. But importantly, the electromagnetic particles in the shower will actually excite the nitrogen nuclei, the nitrogen molecules in the atmosphere, which causes them to fluoresce. And so Auger can actually observe this fluorescence with the fluorescence telescopes, and the intensity of that fluorescence is directly related to the amount of energy being deposited in the atmosphere, which is directly related to how many particles are in the shower. So they observe these plots, these curves essentially of the intensity of light, and you can map this onto the amount of energy being deposited in every unit column depth or slant depth. And so Auger can actually just directly integrate this curve to get a very precise measurement of the calorimetric energy of the shower. And so then they can go to simulation to see how much of the energy is actually put into invisible energy losses. And from this, they're able to get this very precise measurement of the primary particle's energy. Now, the other important observable that comes out of these fluorescence telescope measurements is the depth of shower maximum, which we call Xmax. And I'm going to talk in just a second about why Xmax is a really useful observable. Now, the ground array just sees the last few layers of this shower, right? So you have to do a bit more work to actually back out what the energy of the primary particle was. But you can calibrate the ground detector to the fluorescence telescope's measurements. And so this allows you to get a precise measurement of the primary energy even when you only see the ground signal. And this is really important because the ground detector has 100% duty cycle, basically. It's on about all the time. But the fluorescence telescopes, you need really favorable conditions. It has to be a clear moonless night. So its duty cycle is only like 10%, something like that. So most of your statistics are really coming from the ground array. Okay, what about that Xmax? So here I have a cartoon of a classic model of particle showers, the Heitler-Matthews model. And in this model, you imagine that particles travel along for an interaction length. And then once they reach that interaction length, they'll produce a bunch of particles, and all those particles share the energy equally, okay? And this continues on again until energy losses start to dominate. So we can imagine that we have a proton, a cosmic ray proton that enters the Earth's atmosphere with some energy E, And it's not hard to convince yourself that the higher energy that particle is, the more particles will end up in the shower at maximum. And in order to do this, you're going to need more generations of this shower to develop. And so this tells you that the depth of shower maximum, Xmax, increases with the energy. And if you sit down and you do the back of the envelope calculation, you'll see that it actually goes like the log of the energy. Now, let's imagine that instead of a proton, we have a nucleus with some mass number A that arrives at Earth. And we can do the same calculation quite simply if we use what's called the superposition approximation, which assumes that this nucleus with mass number A is essentially just A nucleons, A separate nucleons that happen to be traveling along together, and each of them has an energy E over A. And once you make this approximation, the same calculation follows, and you'll find that instead of scaling as the log of the primary energy, Xmax will scale as the log of the primary energy per nucleon, okay? And so from this equation, we can see why measuring Xmax is useful, right? Because if we have a measurement of the energy, which we get from integrating that light curve with the fluorescence telescopes, and we measure Xmax, which we can see directly from these measurements of the fluorescence telescopes, we can back out what the primary particle's chemical composition was. Now, it's not quite that simple because there are uncertainties in particle physics at these energies. So the exact mapping between the mass number and these two observables isn't quite known, but people have models of it, and you can adopt one of those models and see what you get out for the composition. So with all that being said, this is kind of the state of cosmic ray data today. So you see on the left here, the very well measured spectrum of ultra energy cosmic rays that I've kind of boxed in. Here, and those orange points are the ones from Pierre Auger, and the green stars are from the telescope array. And then on the right are those composition sensitive observables, the mean Xmax and the sigma Xmax. So these are the first two moments of the Xmax distributions in each energy bin. And just to say, the mean Xmax is probing the average mass number, whereas sigma Xmax is probing kind of the diversity of different elements in a given energy bin. And you see these colored curves on these plots are what you would expect for purely proton primaries and purely iron primaries in red and blue. And the different line styles are different assumptions about hadronic interactions at these energies. So with this data in hand, you could ask, you know, what can we actually learn about cosmic ray source populations from just this spectrum and composition data alone? And to do this, I'm going to adopt a model of cosmic ray sources. And this is the model of Unger-Farran-Antidorqui, or as I usually call it, the UFA model for short. And this isn't a model of actually how cosmic rays are accelerated. It's a model of what happens to cosmic rays after they've exited the accelerator and entered the surrounding host environment, okay? And you could imagine that that host environment is characterized by some turbulent magnetic field and an ambient photon field. So that is, cosmic rays diffuse through this magnetic field. They'll have interactions with those photons, and those photons will break heavy nuclei up into lighter nuclei. So that even if you had a very pure composition coming out of the accelerator, as long as it's not just protons, you would expect to get a mixed composition actually exiting the source environment. And so once they exit the source environment, they'll propagate to Earth. And this model's been shown to really nicely account for both the spectrum and also the composition sensitive observables. And so I'm going to apply this model to try to learn something about what I mentioned in the title of my talk, the evolution of cosmic ray sources. So this.
Sorry, just a question.
Please, yeah.
When you show two slides ago, one before that one, the width of those lines, I guess the
over here.
Different styles in the top right plot, or that one.
Yeah.
Is that an uncertainty? And where is that coming from? Or What is the difference between the solid and the dotted line, basically?
These are different assumptions about hadronic interactions at ultra-high energies.
So it's something to do with the cosmic ray interaction with the atmosphere, or?
Yeah, that initial interaction and also how the shower develops.
Okay,
so,
okay.
Yeah.
That's in your model, or?
No, we just take these from the literature, yeah. Yeah, that's its own business of trying to come up
so
with these.
So when you say particle physics uncertainties, do you mean, what do you mean exactly? Is it the PDFs or nuclear physics? What's the?
Yeah, so we don't have measurements of hadronic interactions at these energies, right? Not only at these energies, but also in the parts of parameter space that we're interested in, right? So. The part of the parameter space we're interested in is very high rapidity, right? That's along the beam line, if I'm remembering, right? And so they're very, very forward interactions, and there aren't measurements of the secondaries there. Okay, so there's some efforts now to try to do better measurements of what's coming out, but we still won't have the energy scales that we're interested in at current accelerators. Okay. Here, right. Okay, so this plot on the left is depicting various source evolutions that cosmic ray sources might follow. So on the y-axis here is the cosmic ray power density versus redshift. And here I'm mostly plotting kind of a parametric model that's just a single power law at low redshifts, and then it goes up to some kind of critical redshift, and then it'll just be an exponential cutoff. And you see that they fall into just three classes in this simple model. There are positive source evolutions that assume cosmic ray sources were more luminous in the past, uniform source evolutions that assume they're as luminous today as they ever were, and then negative source evolutions, which say the most local sources are actually the most luminous. So you can do a lot just adopting these kind of parameterizations, but you could also take a model that's astrophysically informed, and that's what this green line is. So this is the evolution following the star formation rate. And so what you can do is adopt each of these models and then fit the cosmic ray spectrum and composition to the best of your ability. And that's what this plot on the right is showing. So here's that power law index on the x-axis versus the reduced chi-squared. The different colors are different hadronic interaction models, and the different marker styles are for different assumptions of the shape of the photon, the ambient photon field in the source environment. And so depending on all your assumptions, the details kind of vary here, but I think there's a clear takeaway message, which is that generally the fit improves when the source evolution is more positive than negative, right? And in particular, things like star formation rate are actually among the very best fits. So this kind of very indirect kind of analysis allows us to learn something about the evolution, but what I'm going to be talking about later in the talk are ways that I think we can actually measure this source evolution.
Sorry, but what goes in the fit? So how does the fit gets to know anything about redshift?
So you have to assume this source evolution to know how cosmic ray sources are distributed in the universe, right? So essentially, you can think of their luminosity depending on redshift.
I see. Okay.
So how many parameters besides this power are going into this fit?
Depending on how many we keep free, the full model has 8 free parameters that are controlling properties of the extragalactic cosmic ray population. And then there are 4 others that are basically nuisance parameters because the transition from galactic to extragalactic is somewhere between 10 to the 17 and 10 to the 18 electron volts. Okay.
So yeah, I want to ask a question about this. Can you go one slide backward? So yeah, should we really kind of, what we should learn from this plot? Because first of all, the sensitivity to the model seems to be bigger, to the model, I mean, of the hadronic interaction, seems
right.
to be actually bigger than to this evolution or comparable. And also chi-square for none of them is actually good, right? It's either three or five.
Yeah, that's a, it's true.
So none of them fits actually. So should we really take any model? Like, can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, for sure. It's a good point. Explaining this data is difficult. And I would note that like this model is doing better than pretty much anything else. So that should be kept in mind. But you're right, there are significant uncertainties that are going into this. And so it leaves a lot to be desired in terms of trying to make an inference about the actual source evolution. Maybe you kind of take this as a notion more than anything. But it does appear that generally, under any set of assumptions you make, this fit is improving as the source evolution becomes more positive. Now, the things I'm going to talk about later in the talk are trying to get away from this a little bit, in that they are ways that you could hopefully actually measure this source evolution.
Yeah, and also another question. So this model that kind of follows star formation rate, so what's the physics behind? Is it the idea that the cosmic rays are produced by supernovas or something like that?
Right, it's a good question. So you could imagine some very extreme kinds of supernova might follow the star formation rate. I believe starburst galaxies will follow this sort of source evolution as well. So there are candidate models, I would say, for this evolution. But here we're kind of taking a candidate source agnostic approach. We're not really trying to think about anything in particular and just see where the data leads us.
Yeah, I was just thinking that people, well, related it to AGNs, right? And I don't know if AGNs actually follow the star formation rate, but yeah, I would not see any like reason why they should.
No, you're right. AGN wouldn't follow this. It'll be a stronger evolution, essentially a more positive evolution than star formation rate. And I will touch on that a little bit later. Or there will be plots that have this AGN source evolution.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so with that, to go back and mention that other way of detecting cosmic rays that I mentioned before, which is through the detection of the neutral secondaries they produce. And so cosmic rays will produce gamma rays and neutrinos, not only in their interactions with the CMB and the extragalactic background light, but also in their interactions with these photon fields inside the source environment. And so this means that by making predictions about these neutral secondaries and measuring them, we could actually learn something about the properties of the sources themselves. So before we move on, I should just give you a quick overview of the state of high-energy astroparticle data today. And so that's what this plot is showing. On the right here in green, you see the ultra-energy cosmic ray spectrum. On the left in blue is the extragalactic gamma ray background that's been measured by Fermilat up to about a TeV. And then in the middle are these astrophysical neutrinos that have now been observed by IceCube between about 100 TeV and 10 PeV. And I think that recently IceCube's actually extended this to slightly lower energies. But really importantly, there's been no neutrinos observed above 10 PeV. And so what you can do then is, you know, fit the data as best you can for a set of model parameters, and then you should make the predictions of what the gamma ray and neutrino fluxes would be in that model, and then you can compare them to data, and if gamma rays actually start to, the gamma ray fluxes start to be larger than the observations from Fermilat, or too many neutrinos are produced where none have been observed, then you can rule out this part of parameter space and try to back out properties of cosmic ray sources. So just to very quickly show you how this kind of works, here on the left, I have some predictions of the gamma ray flux for various assumptions of that source evolution. And so I'm going from negative to positive source evolutions moving upwards. And you see that the shape of this spectrum is quite sensitive to what the source evolution is, but it's always comfortably below the Fermilat data. So nothing's being constrained yet. It is kind of a tantalizing possibility. Like if you could manage to separate out this flux, you'd get a nice measurement of the source evolution, but I'm not aware of any ways to do that today. On the right-hand side are some predictions of the neutrino flux as we change the temperature of the ambient photon field. So as the temperature of that photon field increases, the overall neutrino flux is going to increase, and eventually you'll start to violate these bounds from ice cube and black, and then you can rule out these temperatures. So this has allowed us to set an upper limit on the black body temperature of about 4,000 Kelvin. If you like to think about a peak energy in a broken power law, that's about 500 millielectron volts. Okay, so I mentioned these great fits. You get to the cosmic ray spectrum and composition. Now I'm going to qualify that a bit. So how good a fit you get to the composition depends a lot on the hadronic interaction model that you adopt. We saw that also from the chi-squared plot earlier. And in particular, for this model of hadronic interactions, EPOS-LHC, you see that the predictions systematically undershoot the measurements in both mean Xmax and sigma Xmax, which is telling you that the predicted composition is both too heavy and too pure at the highest energies. So this could be a deficiency in our model. It could be telling us that this model of hadronic interactions is wrong, but it could also be telling us that there's something new entering at the highest energies that hasn't been accounted for yet.
Sorry, I don't understand what the tension is. What?
So this black line you see is systematically below all these points, and same on the right.
What's the black line? Exactly?
This is the prediction from our model. So we fit the cosmic ray spectrum and composition as well as we could, and you see this is the best we can do.
Doesn't that tell you that your composition is wrong then?
Yeah, apparently there's something wrong in the composition.
Okay, got it.
Yeah.
What's the origin of changing the slope of your model and also of the spectrum? Yeah,
here?
It goes up and then it just kind of goes out and then it goes up again?
Yeah, so this isn't, remember this isn't composition directly, so pure compositions follow essentially this slope.
Yeah.
So you see it's a transition from being dominated by one nucleus to the highest or the heaviest nucleus in our model.
Sorry, but how do you get the black line without the cosmic ray data?
Sorry, without the cosmic ray? So we're fitting the data in this model as best we can. And we're, as we saw on the previous plot, some of these chi-squareds are not near one, right?
Oh.
Okay? So this is just as good as it gets under this assumption of hadronic interaction model, of hadronic interactions.
What's stopping the model, from changing the composition to fit this better?
Because essentially, so what you assume is that you have the cosmic rays at the source are all, regardless of their composition, will all be accelerated to the same maximum energy per charge. Okay? And then, so that sets you to have protons at the lowest energies, your heaviest nucleus at the very highest energies, and then any additional changes in the composition you get come from breaking up these nuclei in the source. So it's basically, apparently, it's a little too simple of a model is what's going on. So maybe what I'm about to say will address some questions. One way to improve this would be to assume that there's something, another population of cosmic rays entering at the highest energies that this model is not accounting for quite yet. And
for your best fit model, did you take the star formation evolution, or did you?
For this model?
Yeah.
This model is star formation right now. Okay, so one thing that would improve this is if there was a population of extremely high energies, I'm running out of the right words here, the highest ultra high energy cosmic rays that were actually protons, okay? So here we assume just a single power law spectrum of protons is entering, and it will have this hard spectral index of e to the minus one, so that it really just comes in at the very highest energies. And then we explore exponential cutoffs between the 10 to 1,000 EEV range. Okay, so this exponential cutoff would be what you'd expect the maximum energy of the accelerator to be. And that leaves us with one free parameter, FP, that's just controlling this normalization. And so adopting this, you'd want to know, does it actually improve the fit? And is it ruled out by neutrino and gamma ray data already? So just to show you the effect here, this was our prediction for the composition before adding in this extra component. And once I add it in, you see that both the agreement with the mean Xmax and especially the sigma Xmax have improved by quite a bit. Okay, so it seems to be doing the job. Now, just to show you I'm not cherry picking this, let me show you the broader parameter space here. Okay, so here's this full parameter space. So on the x-axis is that cutoff energy. On the y-axis is the strength of this component, the overall normalization of this new component. And this bottom row here corresponds to not having this proton component at all. So it's back to that vanilla model I described earlier. And the colors here is indicating how much the fit is improved or degraded compared to not having this component. And so for us, redder is better and blue is worse. And you see there's a large swath of parameter space here where the fit's improving. And it can improve by quite a bit. This deepest, or this reddest part here would be more than 5 sigma improvement over not having this component. Eventually, this component, if it becomes too large, will actually start to violate composition measurements from Pierre Auger. And so you can start to exclude it based on measurements of the cosmic ray composition alone. But this is, I think, kind of tantalizing evidence, phenomenological evidence, that maybe there's something else going on at the higher energies, and it's not just the heaviest nuclei that Pierre Auger is seeing. There's something
else. Where is GZK on this plot?
The GZK threshold is 10 to the 19.7, so somewhere in here. And of course, this is a cutoff, so there will, even down here, be protons at those energies. Yeah.
Just thinking, your original vanilla model, the ratio of, say, protons to heavy elements that you're accelerating, that's free. You can have as little as zero protons and as many as infinite protons and vice versa with the heavy elements.
So it can't be purely protonic coming out of the accelerator. For sure, that cannot describe the data. You need heavy elements.
But that ratio is free in your vanilla model.
Right. So coming out of the accelerator, we can set that to be free. To simplify the number of free parameters, we often just inject a single nucleus coming out of the accelerator, and this does a very good job of describing the data. And then we get our mixed composition by those interactions with photons that will break up that heavy nucleus.
I see. And just taking a different approach for that, like taking different heavy elements at the origin, doesn't improve the fit.
I don't think that it improves the fit much, because you're still fairly constrained, right? Because of this fact that all the mass groups are still going to be accelerated to the same maximum energy per charge. So you can change the relative levels of them, but essentially the protons that are created by breaking up, say, iron are going to end up at roughly the same energy as the ones that were directly accelerated by the accelerator.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
So, I mean, you focused on adding in a new power law spectrum, and you decided, that's going to be protons. That's probably sensible, but do you think this would change materially if I assumed it was helium for no good reason other than just to see what happens?
So helium will still, I think, improve the fit to the composition. I mean, in principle, I would imagine that anything above here in its prediction for mean Xmax is going to improve the fit in some way. Now, you'd expect, again, if accelerators are accelerating through some electromagnetic mechanism so that they have this maximum energy per charge, that the first mass group you see would be protons. Those would be the lowest energy ones. But yes, that's totally true. Unfortunately, it will change what you get for the neutral secondaries quite a bit. So protons are a little bit more exciting in that sense. So, okay, what about those neutral secondaries? So here, let me just say, I'm gonna make predictions for the neutral secondaries for every point in this plot that's allowed by cosmic ray data.
Can you remind us what minus one means for FP?
FP?
Yeah.
Sorry, not a very useful. So it's the amount of energy that's in this proton component compared to the total cosmic ray spectrum. But this is escaping the source. So it's the fraction of the total energy. It's a normalization thing, right? So
if you put like 10% of the energy in this pure proton component at 10 to the 19, you get a better fit.
Right. But okay, so the reason Okay, so I think that something meaningful can be said about the y-axis here, where this maximum is. But it's worth noting that the best fit is at lower energies here because that's where most of the cosmic ray data is, right? Like the composition measurements run out at lower energies than the spectrum. And so you're not affecting the fit quite as much by going to higher energies.
Is there a propagation model here so that this analysis knows about the GZK limit?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay, so that's all.
That's all being taken care of. Yep. Okay. Yeah. In fact, I want to emphasize at this point that these protons, to take a very simple model, we're not putting them through a source environment. We're just saying they're escaping some source with this spectrum. So any neutrinos and gamma rays that they produce are only going to be through those propagation effects, like the GZK. Okay, so on the left here, we have the gamma ray predictions for these two different hadronic interaction models. You see that the width is super narrow, so they're not really sensitive to these protons, and they're always comfortably below the data, so that all checks out. On the right here, you see the range of neutrino predictions, which is huge. Okay, they're super sensitive to the details of this component. And if it has high enough energies with a large enough normalization, you get this population of GZK neutrinos at EEV energies that many people are interested in. But importantly, no matter where we are in this parameter space, we're always below the ice cube predictions. So the cosmic ray composition alone has already constrained this so that you don't need neutrino observatories quite yet. You can't constrain them. Now, of course, new neutrino observatories are coming. And so they will be able to constrain this, in particular RNOG and GRANT.
But isn't your assumption that the neutrinos come only outside of the source a bad one?
A bad one?
More neutrinos?
Right, there could be more.
Sorry?
There definitely could be more, yeah. So we're going to open this up in just a second to the more general set of assumptions. Yeah. One really exciting implication, let me not spend too much time on this slide. One exciting implication is that some of these protons you should actually be able to see at Earth. So you would have these ultra high rigidity particles, that's the energy per unit charge. And so if you could identify them, you could actually imagine doing cosmic ray astronomy now because the deflections will be as small as they get, more or less. But that'll only tell you about the most local sources because of this GZK horizon. So it would be nice if we could learn about this population more generally. And the way that I'm going to propose we could do that is motivated by this plot. So here I have the proton fraction above 30 eV, that's at Earth. And this is the neutrino flux at 1 eV. And essentially what I've done is I've taken that proton component and I've just uniformly sampled its parameter space. calculated that fit to the cosmic ray spectrum and its predictions for neutrinos and gamma rays, and then placed it into this plot. And the color here is indicating whether or not it violates neutrino or cosmic ray constraints. So those are the gray points, and the blue points are what are left over. So this is what is realistically possible. And the extent of this blue region is constrained moving to the right by those composition measurements, and in principle could be constrained moving upwards by constraints from neutrino experiments, but as we saw in the previous slide, that's not currently true, or that's not currently happening. And what you see right away from this plot is there's this super tight correlation here, right? Where the neutrino flux is very closely related to the proton fraction at Earth. And the overall normalization of this line actually depends on the source evolution. So here it's for m equals 2. Let me plot it for two more source evolutions so you can see. So for more positive source evolutions, you'll get more neutrinos for a given proton fraction. And for more negative source evolutions, you'll get fewer. And so nature is going to realize one point in this plot, right? So nature's going to pick out some point here. And that point is only going to be compatible with a finite set of source evolutions, right? So in particular here, this point could be explained by m equals 2, maybe marginally by m equals 1, but certainly not by m equals 3. And so I can go through kind of this exercise for every point in this parameter space, looking at all the source evolutions that we are considering. So we consider from m equals minus 7 to plus 7, like crazy source evolutions, just to see. And that's what this plot is showing. Again, proton fraction versus the neutrino flux, same axes. And now the color is indicating the degree to which different source evolutions could actually realize this point in parameter space. So darker colors here mean that the source evolution would be more constrained. There's fewer possibilities for the source evolutions that could actually realize a point in this plane. And so you could imagine that a neutrino detector is deployed into the field. And for a second, we'll take RNOG as an example. So maybe RNOG will measure the one EEV neutrino flux to be here, okay? And right away, this would tell us that the source evolution has to be stronger than m equals 3, because otherwise you don't get, it's not possible to produce so many neutrinos. And it would tell us that the proton fraction has to be at least 1%. And then you could wait around a bit longer for the next generation of cosmic ray observatories to measure the proton fraction. So here I'll pick out the Global Cosmic Ray Observatory, or GCOS, and maybe it measures the proton fraction to be something like this, about 1%. And that will pick out a point in this plot, right? And once we have that point that apparently nature has handed us, we'll be able to we'll essentially have measured what this source evolution is. So here, very fortuitously, nature has picked a point where this constraint on the source evolution is quite strong. So if this is what nature realizes, we could say the source evolution has to be roughly m equals 5. But as we said before, this isn't including interactions in the source environment. So what happens if you allow for that possibility? Sorry, two slides are the same. And this is what happens. You go from this really nice correlation and all hell breaks loose. There's just a huge range of possibilities of what the source environment could be like, okay? So marginalizing over those creates this huge dispersion, but a correlation does still exist, so we can try to play the same game, just see what happens. And this is the plot you would get allowing for the possibility of interactions in the source. You'll see there's a lot more yellow here, right? So things are not as constrained as they were previously, but on kind of the edges of this plot, there are nice points where we could still say something quite strong about what the source evolution is. Maybe nature is kind, or maybe it's quite cruel and we're in this yellow region, in which case we can't really say anything. But one important point is there's not anything special about one EEV in some neutrino experiments will actually be most sensitive around 10 PeV. So you could make the same plot for 10 PeV. This correlation still exists. This is the plot you would get. So things are shifted around a little bit. And even if you could only, say, set a lower limit with a measurement at 1 EV, maybe you could also set an upper limit with a measurement at 10 EEV and say something concrete about the range of possible source evolutions. So this brings me to the end of the first part. I promise the second part's super short by comparison, but I just think this is a natural place if anyone has any further questions. But the thing I really like about this is it's a truly multi-messenger measurement, right? Am I measuring the neutrino flux and the cosmic ray proton fraction? We're going to gain access to the source evolution of these proton sources that otherwise would be inaccessible through either messenger alone. So I'll pause quickly if anyone dares.
You are saying there's a lot more protons coming out of the source than we expected. Mm-hmm. Therefore, in your first case, you're saying that neutrinos are produced as a consequence of that in the propagation.
Mm-hmm.
You get that nice correlation.
Yep.
But now they can also be produced at the source.
Yep.
And then let's say most of those neutrinos are much lower energy. And then you can talk about IceQ as a way to constrain this, or no?
Yeah, in fact, they won't be lower energy because the energy of the neutrinos is actually dictated by the energy per nucleon of the cosmic ray. So neutrinos, if they're photopion produced, are essentially going to always have about 5% of the energy per nucleon of the cosmic ray. Now, it doesn't matter which photon field it's actually producing off of. So the photon field is just setting the threshold energy, really.
So you need EEV neutrino astronomy to do this. Is that
the statement? For sure, yeah. And you need these protons, essentially, to get any EEV neutrinos, yeah.
This is assuming this is the explanation to that discrepancy you showed us.
Yes, yep.
Is it a likely scenario that you just start zeroing in on what the major sources are here so that you can sort of figure out source evolution just based on other observations of like AGN and GRB evolution as a function of redshift?
You mean other measurements that would allow us to constrain this? Or?
Like if it comes in near AGNs, for instance, I can just start trying to use the redshift.
Yeah, if we had other evidence that it was AGNs were really the sources of cosmic rays, then for sure we would just adopt it and see what happens. We wouldn't really need this at all then. Yeah. Or at the very least, we could make a prediction then for what the neutrino flux at EEVs would be, but yeah. Anything else?
Yeah, actually, why don't you use the IceQ sources as a way to inform your fit here?
What are the IceQ sources?
Well, we know two, right? So there was the laser and then...
Yep, so people have done studies of, you know, what different source populations would produce. Again, we're taking kind of a source agnostic approach here. Again, the variety of predictions is quite large, partially because the ice cube neutrinos are at much lower energies, so they don't really need to talk to such high energy protons to be produced. Okay, let me quickly wrap this up. So I mentioned earlier this dipole in the cosmic ray sky. And the fact that this dipole exists might be sort of a surprise, right? Because we usually like to think of our universe as being this nice, homogeneous, isotropic place. And of course, that's true at large scales, but we know that at small scales, that's certainly not true. So this is the local large-scale structure near Earth, coming from the Cosmic Flows database. And you see that it's definitely not isotropic. And so if we took a more kind of Earth-centric view of the universe, it would look something like this, right? Where at small scales, very near to Earth, you have this local large-scale structure, and then at high redshifts, the universe becomes homogeneous and isentropic. And there's kind of this fuzzy redshift I've put here that's the transition between the two. Now, cosmic rays don't see the whole universe, right? Cosmic rays have a horizon that's actually fairly nearby, about 100 megaparsecs. That's due to this GZK effect and extragalactic magnetic fields. And so they mostly probe this very local large-scale structure. And so here I'm taking from a paper, a very nice paper by Ding et al., where they just assumed that cosmic ray accelerators actually follow the mass distribution, and so locally they'll follow this local large-scale structure. If you make that assumption, this is what the cosmic ray sky looks like at the edge of the galaxy, okay? Then you have to do those magnetic field deflections, and you get this map actually is what you would observe on Earth, okay? And you see that there's pretty good agreement between what Auger is seeing on the top and what this model is predicting. And so you might ask, you know, should there be a dipole in the ultra-high energy neutrino sky? And your first instinct might be no, neutrinos don't have a horizon. And that's true, right? That's why we love neutrinos. They don't get attenuated. They don't have any significant interactions. But if neutrinos at the highest energies are only produced by cosmic rays, and Auger sees a cutoff in the ultra-energy cosmic ray spectrum, that means that there's a maximum cosmic ray energy, and that maximum energy is going to be imprinted onto the neutrino spectrum. And so if I go out and I try to observe the ultra-high energy neutrino sky, and I make a map above some threshold energy, just by setting that threshold energy, I will induce a horizon in my sky map, just because eventually the highest energy neutrinos will redshift out of my band. And so I can kind of, as an observer, tune how much of the universe I want to see in neutrinos. So maybe there is a dipole. How could we calculate what the strength would be? So here I have a very back of the envelope Mickey Mouse calculation for that. I just want to warn you. But here I imagine that the local large scale structure is just a perfect dipole. And so then the total dipole that we would see in the neutrino sky would be a sum of that local large-scale structures dipole, plus there would be a dipole from the high redshift universe, that'd be like the CMB dipole, and the relative weight here is just going to be the fraction of flux coming from the nearby universe. This depends on two things. One, the neutrino spectrum being produced by each source. So here, again, is the neutrino data from IceCube. I've just drawn a power law that fits this data and put an exponential cutoff at 1 eV. I think that this is a fairly conservative assumption about what the neutrino spectrum might actually look like. So we can go out, we can measure this, hopefully one day we see this. And one of the great things is, because neutrinos don't have many interactions, the spectrum that we observe at Earth is roughly going to be the spectrum that's produced by sources. So we can kind of get this piece directly through observation. And the source evolution is the same problem we always have. We don't know what the source evolution is, but we can adopt one for this calculation. And so then you can just get this relative weight. Here I've written down the equation for the total flux in neutrinos at Earth above some threshold energy from sources within this horizon. I can open up that integral in redshift. You see it splits into this local part and the part from the high redshift universe, and I can just read off what this fraction is for this relative weight between the two dipoles. Now, this horizon's only a hard cutoff. It's only like a sharp horizon if the cutoff in the neutrino spectrum is sharp. So if it's actually an exponential cutoff, you should still integrate to infinity. So this would be a little bit more correct. And we can go ahead and calculate what this dipole amplitude would be. And so here's that dipole amplitude as a function of this threshold energy that the observer sets. And this is just relative to the cutoff energy in the spectrum. But again, it's an exponential cutoff, so you can be above this energy. That's okay. And you see that as we increase the threshold energy, we're probing less and less of the high redshift universe. And so this dipole amplitude is increasing. But, well, so I'll just say that in kind of this Mickey Mouse calculation here, it could be as high as 4%. We're working on a more exact calculation. But I think the really exciting part is if you plot this as a function of source evolution. Okay, so again, here's my different threshold energies. Source evolution is now on the x-axis. And what you see is that there's a pretty strong dependence on what the source evolution is. So if you went out and you measured the neutrino spectrum, and then you made this sky map above some threshold energy, you would pick out one of these lines, and then you calculated the dipole amplitude you see for that map, it would pick out a point in this plot, right? And you will have essentially measured, or at least strongly constrained, the source evolution of the bulk of neutrino sources. So I told you it was quick. That is just the last piece of my talk. So I just want to emphasize that if cosmic rays are the only sources of ultra energy neutrinos, they should have a maximum energy. So we should expect to see anisotropies in the ultra high energy neutrino sky. Maybe this can be used to actually find the source of measure the source evolution of neutrino sources and therefore cosmic ray sources. And we're working right now on doing a more exact calculation of this. So with that, I'll just say thank you. Happy to take any more questions.
Sensitivity that we have to this dipole? Like, can you actually see?
Would you be able to see it?
Yeah.
So it depends on how strong it is. And it's really a question of statistics, right? If you can statistically distinguish it from isotropy. If it's weak, if it was like 4%, like this calculation is showing, you're going to need a lot of neutrinos, like tens of thousands of neutrinos, okay? That's a big problem, obviously.
Of what energy?
Above your threshold. Whatever threshold you set.
But is a threshold of PV realistic? Or are we talking?
It depends on what the maximum energy is, right? That's the only thing that matters, is the ratio of the maximum energy to the threshold you set. So, where is my plot? Yes. If this is really the last data point and then it just cuts off, you could probably pretty easily, right, even today maybe, start to make these maps and just be one or two orders of magnitude below the cutoff. It's a question if you'd have enough statistics still, but this argument does not depend on EEV neutrinos existing.
Does your argument depend on how many neutrinos are produced at the source by these protons?
So here we don't need those protons in particular. These could be neutrinos just from the cosmic ray, the like kind of vanilla cosmic rays that we see.
How many neutrinos are produced by cosmic rays at the source?
I mean, in the sense that that's going to determine how many you observe at Earth, right? So the thing that will matter, of course,
the dipole argument doesn't hold, right? Because those neutrinos will travel without any, there will be no, right, they would just travel.
I had the same question, actually.
The dipole would be in a different direction, but you would still have it, right?
But what?
Sorry?
I didn't follow that argument at all. I mean, like, so you're saying that for these GZK energies, the cosmic ray sources will all have some sort of like GZK volume around them,
mm-hmm.
Where the cosmic rays can penetrate to.
Right.
But if they produce neutrinos within that volume.
But the thing is,
can now reach us.
Yep.
Yes.
So there's no reason to believe that those cosmic ray sources only exist in the GZK volume, right? They should exist farther from Earth, too.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
And so those neutrinos at high redshifts, where we'll never see their cosmic rays because they're outside their rays, but we'll see the neutrinos. Yeah.
Right. And so then why is there a dipole in those neutrinos instead of just the CMB dipole?
Well, that depends on your energy threshold, right? Because it's setting how much of the high redshift universe you're probing. If I set my threshold to be very near the cutoff energy of the neutrino spectrum, I can probe, whatever, within the GZK horizon only, if I tuned my threshold to do that. And it becomes a question of statistics at that point.
Sorry,
so if
because of redshift, just because of redshift, you mean you would, no?
It was the
right
one that they're coming
from outside the GZK horizon, they'll redshift out of my band.
It's just because of redshift, yeah.
It's just
Like, but intrinsically, there's cosmic rays produced, you know, intrinsically way past the GZK.
Mm-hmm.
And so if they can make neutrinos before they get attenuated, why can't we then see those neutrinos?
You are changing your max, right?
So, sorry?
Then you will be changing your max, I see.
Changing the mass.
I think he's
Emax.
Right. So the maximum neutrino energy compared to my threshold energy for the sky map that I make is going to set some maximum redshift. That sets a horizon. Because beyond that, even the highest energy neutrino that's produced will redshift out of my band. So I'll only see neutrinos from more local in the universe than this scale.
So the assumption is that there is like just intrinsically some maximum energy.
Yep. Which we have observational evidence for, right? Here I'm assuming neutrinos are only produced by ultra energy cosmic rays. I think in terms of like standard model physics, that's the going assumption. And cosmic rays seem to have a maximum energy. We see the spectrum cutting off.
Due to GZK, or?
We don't know. It's either due to the GZK effect or accelerators, for some reason, are just not able to accelerate particles to higher energies. It's an open question which of these two possibilities it is. But it appears that the spectrum is cutting off.
So let me ask you this then. Suppose we build like the most amazing neutrino telescope.
Mm-hmm.
We have as many data points as you have for your cosmic rays.
Yeah.
And it follows like the exact same distribution. Is there in that pool?
The spectrum follows? It has the same spectrum, basically.
Yeah, basically. There's the same cutoff.
Yeah.
Is there a dipole in that case?
We should be able to measure a dipole then. Yeah. Now, of course, it won't look as dipolar. There's not as much power in the low energy harmonics as, what am I looking at? Sorry. As for cosmic rays. Here, right? Like, this map actually does look pretty dipolar.
So,
but part of the...
Again. So suppose those neutrinos have the same distribution, but they are all produced at the source. They're not produced
by
the GZK.
Here, yeah. Okay.
Is there a dipole?
Yes.
That?
Yes. Actually, the GZK neutrinos here would contribute more to the high redshift portion. And so it would decrease the signal, the dipole signal. But how many GZK neutrinos there are super sensitive to the assumption of the number of protons you have escaping at the highest energy. So we didn't explore that. Sorry, but just to finish what I wanted to say, right? This dipole here in cosmic rays actually looks kind of dipolar, but neutrinos won't have these galactic magnetic field deflections. So we should expect that the sky map actually looks more like this. So there should be more power at smaller scales actually in the neutrino sky. And so we think that we should actually be able to take advantage of that fact to decrease the number of neutrinos we need to detect to actually measure something here.
Any more questions for Marco? If not, let's thank Marco again.
Okay.